Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 28th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, meltaway electronics, the impact of climate change on Genghis Khan, and how children are like little scientists.
That's a case where even 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds who are just beginning to add and subtract seem to be unconsciously able to calculate these probabilities.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Imagine that when you upgrade your cell phone this week, your old phone harmlessly dissolves away. No more electronic waste sitting in stasis at the dump. John Rogers and colleagues tested the feasibility of transient electronics by creating nanomembrane microchips capable of dissolving in their environment after a programmed amount of time. Science's Edward Hermy spoke with Rogers from his office in Illinois.
The best way to think about it is to consider the kinds of electronic devices that are out there today. They're all built on the rigid, plain, or brittle surfaces of semiconductor wafers. And a hallmark of their operation is that they have extremely long lifetimes. They operate reliably and robustly for many, many years. And that characteristic attribute has been essential to all kinds of consumer electronic devices. What we begin to think about is whether there would be an opportunity for a kind of electronic technology that offers the opposite behavior. In particular, materials, device constructs, layouts, encapsulation schemes that yield integrated circuits with performance attributes, electrical switching parameters that are similar to conventional wafer-based devices, but their key feature is the fact that they physically disappear over time in a controlled engineering manner that can be triggered and whose rate can be programmed in via materials and design rules. And our thought is that that kind of electronics could open up new application opportunities that cannot be addressed with the kind of integrated circuit technology that exists today.
So in your paper, you tested how these dissolvable microchips would work as implants inside the body, where after surgeries, they would provide heat to prevent bacterial infections. But this is just one type of use for these electronics, right?
Yeah, so we think that that's one application area where this kind of technology could be very powerful. I think it's one of three that we're thinking about at the moment. So in the context of an implantable device, imagine as a final step in a surgical procedure, the doctor inserting into your body near the surgical site a piece of electronics that has the ability, for example, to sense, to actuate, to interact with the tissue in a way that could be beneficial in terms of preventing infections, accelerating or monitoring the healing process. And if you could configure a system with those kinds of functions, you would ideally like it to disappear after the wound site is completely healed or the fracture at a bone location is completely mended to remove unnecessary device load from the body. And oh, by the way, that also solves the long-term biocompatibility challenge with devices of that type because the device in this case just disappears. It's completely resorbed into the body. So I think that's a general area where there is significant promise. A second one would be in environmental monitoring. So the implantable devices bioresorb, but you can imagine with appropriate materials, such as the ones that we put forward in this initial publication, the devices could be made to environmentally resorb and disappear in a benign way. Mm-hmm. And that kind of characteristic might be interesting in various scenarios. For example, imagine a chemical waste spill where you might want to distribute hundreds or thousands of sensors across the spill site, which might extend over large areas, so that you can monitor the cleanup process or the attributes of the flow and the distribution and the characteristics of the spill site itself. And in that case, you would like for these monitors to offer function that's relevant for managing the spill, but you would like them eventually to just disappear and resorb into the environment so you don't have to go out and try to collect and recover these monitors. And the third one is really in consumer electronics itself. I think this is a little bit more daunting in terms of a technical challenge, but it addresses an emerging and growing need in disposal and waste management associated with consumer electronic devices, which over time are having shorter and shorter useful lifetimes, not because the electronics is degrading, but because the technology is moving so quickly. People like to update their smartphone every couple of years, for example.
So the base of all of these transient electronics that you're creating is silicon. Why was using silicon so important?
Well, silicon is sometimes referred to as God's material for electronic applications because it has a really spectacular collective set of electronic properties, reliability and operation. It has a high natural abundance. People can grow it in large single crystal forms. They can control the material's composition extremely well. Maybe most importantly, though, is that there's been a half century of worldwide research and development around silicon, fundamental understanding of that material, and also manufacturing approaches and device designs that allow you to do things at incredibly high levels of sophistication at low cost. And so our notion was that if you could figure out how to use silicon in this new kind of transient electronics, that would be the way to go because there's so much knowledge and so much engineering know-how already built around silicon. Now, unfortunately, silicon itself is only very mildly resorbable in any kind of practical sense. In the body, silicon will dissolve. It undergoes hydrolysis to form silicic acid in biofluids at those kinds of pHs, but only a few nanometers per day. And so if you think about that rate, it really precludes the use of the conventional wafer-based format of silicon because there's just too much material. It's too thick. If you compute the time for a silicon chip to resorb in the body, it's about 1,000 years. And so it's really irrelevant to the kind of implantable applications that we're thinking about. But what we found is that there are ways to slice silicon in incredibly thin geometries so that you reduce by many orders of magnitude the total amount of material that has to dissolve via hydrolysis in order to affect transients, but at the same time, thick enough that you can build reliable, high-performance transistors.
As a transient device is working, it's doing everything properly, but how do you prevent it from accidentally doing something wrong as it's degrading, as it's dissolving away? How does it not accidentally do something it wasn't intended to do?
Yeah, so that was a key question, you know, that came up when we first started working on these things. It's great if you have a piece of electronics that is transient, you can program in the rate, but wouldn't the transients itself cause the function to vary over time, which would be maybe not such a good thing. For example, the heater could degrade over time, so the amount of the heat that you're delivering in this particular application is varying in a way that you might not be able to predict very easily. So basically, we decouple the function of the device from the time scale and the processes of transients itself by packaging the system with a material that defines the first time scale of this two-stage transient. That encapsulation or packaging material does not, however, play an active role in the device function itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is you have operational characteristics in terms of the device function that are non-transient, non-time varying, until that encapsulating layer has completely dissolved away. At that point, now the device itself, the active functional components, are exposed, let's say in the case of this implantable device, to biofluids, which start that degradation process. And only at that point do the device characteristics start to decay as a result of the transients in the functional components of the system.
If a device dissolves, where do you actually collect the data if it's sensing an environment or sensing inside of a body? How do you actually collect the data from this device?
Well, you collect it while it's operating. So we have shown that we can deliver power wirelessly to these devices, and we think similar types of concepts will allow us to pull data out from sensors that are operating in the devices. We do have ways to make memory components to these systems that are transient, but as you point out, if those memory devices themselves physically disappear, then that information content is lost.
So what are your next steps? Is this technology ready for use?
Well, I think, you know, this is the first paper for us on transient silicon electronics. So in that sense, I think it's a starting point, certainly not an ending point. We have a lot of work to do. We're focusing on two things. One is developing these kind of transient implantable electronic devices for applications like thermal therapy and others, where we think we have all of the know-how to address the functional requirements. And so we're going down that path. The other one is really focused more on manufacturability, like how do you get these things out of an academic clean room where grad students and postdocs are making the things into kind of a realm that is at least conceptually similar to how Intel makes chips, you know, high volume, low cost, very precise control over the device properties. And so there we have active collaborations with folks that run manufacturing facilities, foundry facilities like that. And we believe that we'll be able to modify the material sets without completely changing the key processing steps that are already in place that would allow the output of that manufacturing process to be modified and repackaged into a transient form. So we're pretty optimistic that that is possible, but it's requiring some ongoing work.
John Rogers, thanks so much for talking with me.
Okay, thank you.
John Rogers describes transient electronics this week in Science. You can check out a video of these electronics melting away at video.sciencemag.org/videolab.
If you give a toddler the math section of the SATs, chances are she won't do very well. But does that mean that she doesn't weigh her options when viewing the world? According to recent research, as their brains develop, children actually employ logic and a form of probabilistic analysis called Bayesian inference to form and test hypotheses about the world around them. You may have heard about this last June on the podcast when we spoke with Laura Schultz about her report in Science. This week, we have a review from Allison Gopnik about how studies like Schultz's have changed our thinking about how kids think. Gopnik began by explaining why this notion of scientific babies has gained traction only recently.
The big change was figuring out new ways of getting babies and children to tell us what they think without actually just asking them. So for babies, for instance, that meant looking at what kinds of things babies look at or what they reach for or what they imitate. And for preschoolers, it meant that you could give them very focused questions about real-life examples. So you could say things like, well, can you make this machine go, instead of saying, do you understand how causality works?
Right. So then, Tommy, how do we know that, you know, what they're thinking is more analytical, more logical than what we expected? You know, give me some examples of how they're incorporating this into their learning.
Well, about 10 years ago, we started doing a whole series of experiments. And what we did in those experiments was to simply show children different kinds of patterns of data about some problem in the world, and then try to figure out what kinds of conclusions the children would draw about the world. And what we discovered was that when we gave children even quite complicated statistical patterns about what was going on in the world, the children could use that information to actually solve real problems, make real decisions, even though the children didn't consciously know about probability or causality or statistics. So, for example, in my lab, we've done dozens and dozens of experiments using a very simple machine we call a Blicket detector. This is a little machine that lights up and plays music when you put some things on it and not others. And we can show the children different statistical patterns about what makes the Blicket detector light up. And then we can just ask them to make the detector light up themselves. And with this very simple technique, it turns out that we can show that even very young children are solving statistical problems. To take just one of the simplest experiments, we showed the children one block makes the machine go 2 out of 3 times, and another block makes the machine go 2 out of 6 times. And then we simply asked the children to make the machine go. Well, they've seen the machine go off 2 times in both cases, but if they're actually calculating the probability of the machine going off, they should prefer the 2 out of 3 block to the 2 out of 6 block.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's just what 4-year-olds do, and in some new experiments that we've done, even 2-year-olds do. That's a case where even 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds who are just beginning to add and subtract seem to be unconsciously able to calculate these probabilities.
Mm.
And in other experiments we've done, we've shown that children can calculate much more complicated kinds of probabilities and statistics to draw more complicated conclusions. We showed, for instance, that children could recognize the difference between data that told you that just one block had to go on the machine to make it go and data that told you that you actually had to have a combination of blocks. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty complicated thing to learn. And yet, four-year-olds learned it very quickly and, in fact, as it turned out, learned it better than undergraduates did.
And so these experiments show that these children are, you know, capable of bringing in this type of behavior when prompted. But how big a role do you think it actually plays in their learning and their understanding of the world around them?
Well, in the past 20 years, just by looking at what children do in their everyday lives, we've discovered that children are learning a great deal about the physical world and also about, say, what's going on in other people's minds. And we can chart the changes in what children understand, for instance, about what's going on in someone's mind as they get older. What we started to do more recently is to show how those natural changes in what children think you can actually explain in terms of this process of testing hypotheses and finding out about them. So, for example, we know that when children are about 2 years old, they start to understand that I could want one thing and you could want something else. Before that, when they're, say, 14 months old, they don't seem to really understand that. They seem to think that everyone will want the same thing, and we did some experiments that showed that. What we started to do now is show that if we actually give these young children evidence, statistical evidence about what someone wants, like how many times do they choose one thing versus another, and if you give them two things together, what decisions do they make, those children can figure out about what they want more quickly than they would do without that evidence. And that makes us think that what's happening in the naturally occurring case is something like that, that the children are using the everyday evidence of what their parents choose to eat or not eat, or what their big brother goes and grabs from them and what he doesn't grab from them, to figure out what's going on in their minds and what they want and what they're like.
Right. So they've got these natural, you know, exploratory capabilities when they're, you know, when they're tinkering and they're playing and they're observing the things around them.
Well, one of the other lines of research which suggests that this is not just something that's happening in the lab is quite beautiful set of studies, not done in my lab, but in other people's labs, particularly Laura Schultz at MIT, that show that when children are just exploring, just playing, they're really experimenting. Mm. And what these experiments show is if you give the children one of these causal problems, like figuring out how the machine works, and then just leave the video recorder running, what you see is that when the children are just completely spontaneously playing, the experimenter isn't even there anymore. What they do is to do a bunch of experiments that will give them just the information that they need to figure out how the toy works.
Well, then an interesting point that you bring up in this review is that when these children are specifically told how to do these certain things, they may actually react in a different way.
Exactly. So one of the great advantages of doing this work is that we can use it to explain what's going on in lots of different kinds of learning. So these new Bayesian theories can explain why children might learn differently in different situations, might learn differently from statistics than from their own experiments, and might learn differently in both of those cases from when they're actually learning from someone who they think is a knowledgeable teacher. And what we and others have shown is that even 3- and 4-year-olds are very sensitive to whether someone is simply giving them information about a system or is actually trying to teach them. And it can be an advantage to learn from a teacher. So if someone who's really a reliable person says to you, here's the facts, that's a quick way to get to the right hypothesis. But again, as I think all scientists will recognize, that can have disadvantages too. Mm-hmm. So one of the disadvantages of just accepting what your graduate mentor or the senior person in your field says on authority is that it might keep you from doing some exploration that could lead you to a new conclusion. And we can show that the same thing is happening with children. So when children are hearing something from a teacher, they are likely to believe that that information and the things that they see are more informative, but that can actually keep them from exploring alternatives that might actually be better alternatives.
Right. So what does all of this mean for, you know, the current way in which we educate young children?
Well, I think it has really important implications for how we educate young children. There's a real push that's coming both from parents and from policymakers to make early childhood education more and more like school, more and more academic. And what you often will hear from people in the policymaking field, for example, is, well, the early kind of development is socio-emotional development, but then we have to give children cognitive skills. And what they mean by cognitive skills is academic things like being able to read or do arithmetic. And I think what this new research shows is that children have amazing cognitive skills even when they're 2, 3, and 4, things like causal inference or statistical analysis or hypothesis testing. And they're exercising those cognitive skills in the course of playing, of experimenting, of exploring. And when we make preschools more academic, more structured, more like schools, we're actually not encouraging children to do the kind of real deep scientific and cognitive work that they're capable of doing when they're exploring with a knowledgeable and attentive person around paying attention to them.
Mm. So do you think that these sorts of studies will lead to policy changes?
Well, I hope so. I mean, there's already, I think, a movement among, for example, preschool teachers who I think have always had the intuition that children are learning through playing, for example, or children are learning through their everyday exploration. And I think the preschool teachers have often felt sort of squeezed between the parents who want to make sure that their children will go to Harvard and the policymakers who want to make sure that if they're funding early childhood, they're getting value for money. Mm. And I think what this new research is showing is that those intuitions are actually right. Rather surprisingly, for instance, we haven't actually had a lot of studies that showed that play was leading to learning in the way that these new studies are showing that play can lead to learning. And we haven't understood the foundational basic science about why play would lead to learning or how play would lead to learning or why what we learn from a teacher in a structured setting is different from what we learn when we're just exploring. Mm. And what we've got now is we're starting to have a really basic fundamental science of learning that can explain why it is that children are learning in the ways that they do and can guide how it is that we understand that they're learning. And that basic science turns out to be much more supportive of the kind of preschoolers' intuition that things like play are important than our usual picture of children learning because we're telling them things in school.
Right. Well, great. Well, Allison Gopnik, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Allison Gopnik writes about the curiously scientific minds of toddlers in a review in this week's Science.
In the 13th century, Genghis Khan ruled a giant swath of the world, with the grasslands of Mongolia at the center. Recent evidence suggests that the effect of climate change on those grasslands might have been central to the rise of the Mongol Empire. I spoke with Mara Vistindal about the connection.
Genghis Khan is one of history's greatest rulers. He ruled an empire that extended from Korea to the Balkans. It was the largest contiguous land empire in the history of the world. Just huge. And he managed to conquer more land in 25 years than the Romans conquered in 400 years. But just how he managed to do that has always been something of a mystery. And there aren't great historical records from his empire. And we just have very few clues to the conditions that were in place at the time that he rose to power. So one of the pieces of that story that we now able to figure out a bit is the climate at the time. And so the researchers that I was following in Mongolia are trying to figure out just what that climate was.
So what leads them to think that climate might have had an impact on an empire like this? Are there other examples from history?
There are. There was a study actually published in Science a few years ago looking at the Roman Empire and the climate conditions at the time that the Romans came to power. They actually found something pretty similar to what the scientists I followed in Mongolia have found in their preliminary work, which is that a warmer, wetter climate took hold around the time that the Romans came to power.
So what kind of evidence were they able to gather that showed that the climate was warmer and wetter at this time?
The group that I was trailing are dendrochronologists, so they're treeing scientists. We went out to actually an old lava field where you have a lot of dead wood and also some live trees to fill, and they took samples from those trees, took cores from the living trees, and the goal there is to try to figure out, through looking at tree rings, how much moisture there was in the area throughout the years. With the piece of dead wood, you can go back over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Together with cores from live trees, that gives you a very complete picture. You can reconstruct the moisture history for an area for centuries. So the idea is to create a timeline, and they're going back centuries, but they're particularly focused on the era when Genghis Khan came to power. And in their preliminary work, they found that beginning in the late 12th century and then the early 13th century, when he was really consolidating his power and conquering a vast territory, the climate was very warm and wet and really would have been ideal for the grassland to flourish and, you know, for raising horses.
Mm-hmm. So that brings us around to how we can make this connection between the change in weather, warmer weather, and increasing ability to conquer the world. How did that come about?
So the idea is that as this unusually moist climate set in, that the grassland would have flourished and it would have been ideal conditions for raising horses, which were, of course, critical to Genghis Khan's army. And they had literally more horsepower to go out and conquer new lands with. And now what's interesting is that this actually flies in the face of some theories that have been put forth over the years. So there are scholars who've actually proposed that Genghis Khan went out and expanded into other territories because of a drought in Mongolia. But that isn't based on any solid data.
Right.
So what Amy Hessel and Neil Peterson, the tree ring scientists I was trailing, what they're working on now really stands to overturn that idea.
And so is there any other scientific evidence that they could gather to support this claim besides tree ring data?
So in addition to tree rings, they're also looking at sediment records. They have people from a wide variety of fields enlisted in their project. And there are scientists who will go out and take sediment cores from the bottoms of lakes in the region. So by dating the sediment cores from these lakes, they can then look for evidence of grazing animals throughout the years. For example, there's a spore called Sporomyela, which is a fungus that lives in the dung of grazing animals. And so levels would have been higher in years where there were a lot of animals at the lake, which is presumably times when the climate was good, when populations were booming. They also have an ecologist on the project who's looking at energy modeling. He has a model that simulates how climate change might affect grassland productivity and water availability. So it's really a multi-pronged approach.
Mm-hmm. And what about the historical record at this time? Is there anything from there that corroborates this climate story?
Well, there really aren't great historical records from the time. The Mongolians didn't leave an extensive written record. There's really only one book from the Mongol side. There are much more extensive Chinese records.
Mm-hmm.
The scientists actually have a historian working with them on this project, Nicola DeCosmo at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. He's going to go over these Chinese records and look for mentions of the climate at the time or of unusually wet years and see if that matches up with what the tree ring scientists find.
So down the road, how will knowing the effects of climate change on the empire of Genghis Khan be helpful for Mongolia today or perhaps the whole world as we experience climate change once again?
Well, there's not a really direct connection, but Mongolia is really dealing with the effects of climate change today. Just around 10 years ago, in the early 2000s, there was a big drought where a lot of animals died. People left the grassland, they flocked to Ulaanbaatar, the capital, and there was really kind of a mass urban migration. What's interesting about Genghis Khan is that in the mid-1200s, as his empire kind of began to fade and lost a bit of its territory, that was around the same time that the climate was becoming less favorable, it was becoming drier. And so those great conditions disappeared, but the empire didn't collapse. Mm-hmm. And Amy and Neil, the scientists on this project, would say that may hold some lessons for Mongolia today.
We see warming during the rise of the empire of Genghis Khan, and then eventually things start to cool off and the empire lives on. Is this something that was happening around the rest of the world? Is this what was happening in, say, Western Europe or in North America or South America?
Well, the period that these researchers are looking at is a pretty complex period around the world. There have always been some big questions surrounding the 12th and 13th centuries, to the point that climate scientists call it the medieval climate anomaly. But really, there's a lot more known about what happened in Europe and even in the U.S., in the Southwest, where there was a lot of drought during this period, than in Asia. And Asia's really been kind of a blank spot for that era until now. So this project could really expand our knowledge of that period of climate history.
All right. Well, Mara Vistendahl, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Mara Vistendahl is a contributing correspondent for Science. She writes about the relationship between climate change and the Mongol Empire in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, I'm here with Science staff writer Carolyn Gramling, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. First up, we have a story on how to make bacteria smile.
Yes. Well, so this story is actually, in a way, it's about wrinkles. We all, of course, want to know how wrinkles actually form and as a first step to preventing them. But what these scientists were doing were actually looking at bacterial biofilms. Mm-hmm. So these slimy communities of bacteria that essentially glom together and then form this sort of scaffolding of proteins and other kinds of molecules such as starches. And they create this kind of surface. And what scientists have noticed is that within the biofilm, sometimes the communities of bacteria form these ridges, which can be extremely tall ridges relative to the height of the biofilm itself. If the bacteria were as tall as humans, then the ridges could be just as tall as the Chrysler Building in New York.
Wow.
So what scientists have found is that these ridges can actually end up having a lot of dead bacteria underneath the fold. And what they were wondering, it became kind of a chicken or egg kind of a question. What came first? Did the dead bacteria come first or did the ridge come first? And this is what they were looking at as a way of trying to understand exactly how these wrinkles can form. So in order to address this question, what they did was make a number of different genetic mutants of a certain kind of bacterium, which is in soil. And they basically engineered all these bacteria to have different genes missing. Each of the genes is somehow involved in making a biofilm. And they wanted to figure out how those genes were involved in creating the biofilm, essentially. And also, they kept track of when the bacteria cells died.
What were the results? What did they find was causing these wrinkles?
So what they found was that a number of these cells would die in patches, and that where they died, where those patches were, was also where these wrinkles would occur. And what they think was going on was that there was overcrowding in the biofilm, that as the biofilm would grow, the cells would start to crowd together, and much like people being crammed onto a Tokyo subway train, that essentially oxygen would get depleted, that the cells would begin to die, and that as a result of that crowding, there was all this tension building up and the scaffolding would start to compress laterally. Mm-hmm. And so it was both the cell deaths that were causing this wrinkle and also the compression of the scaffolding, this actual mechanical property as well. So it was both of these things that were working together.
So why did the researchers want to look at this in the first place? What's the biological or evolutionary importance of this behavior?
Well, what they're really trying to get at here is how all of these different forces, both genetic and mechanical, act together to try to create these kinds of wrinkles. And basically, it's sort of a first order, kind of an understanding of how this works, how these things develop, so that ultimately they might be able to better understand how it would develop in multicellular organisms, such as plants and animals and perhaps even humans.
And are there any other potential applications than the one that I alluded to in the beginning, that they actually were able to draw shapes with these bacterial films? They drew smiley faces.
Yes, by actually being able to engineer where those dead cell patches would occur, they were able to also, therefore, engineer where the wrinkles would happen. So you can make smiley faces out of them. They also, for our science website, they also created bacterial cells that spelled out science.
So from learning how to spell science and slime, our next story looks at a particularly gross way of a certain species of mouse escaping its predators.
Yes, there are these interesting little mice that are native to Africa, and they're called African spiny mice. And a lot of people actually keep them as exotic pets. And what these people have found is that when they handle these mice and the mice get kind of threatened, the mice will actually lose little patches of their skin. And so this is a very interesting property. They don't just lose their skin. They lose very deep patches. It's not superficial. It actually goes all the way down to the muscle. And so the question is, how do they survive this? And researchers who are interested in regeneration properties were interested in these mice to see, you know, what could we actually learn about that? Do they grow the skin back? What happens to them? We know, of course, that there are lizards and salamanders that can regrow a limb.
And how is this different from that?
Well, in that case, you know, that's an entire limb. In this case, it's just these patches of skin that we're looking at.
Just how much skin are they actually losing when they lose their skin?
What they found when they studied these mice was that these mice can lose as much as 60% of the skin covering their backs.
Wow.
Like I said, it's the entire skin that goes all the way down to the muscle, and they can survive this. And what's even more amazing is that it does actually grow back.
So by grow back, do you mean there's scar tissue, or what does it actually look like?
Well, it looks very much, I mean, there's a little bit of scar tissue, but it's almost as good as new. And it turns out that what happens in these mice is actually really similar to what happens in, for example, newts that will grow back a limb, in that the mice develop these embryonic-like cells in the patch of skin that's missing, and then those cells eventually develop into the actual skin cells. And that's similar to what happens in newts when they grow a limb back.
So what do the researchers think they can potentially learn from these mice?
Well, what they're hoping ultimately to be able to do is, if you understand at a molecular level how this regeneration happens, and this is the first time they've seen it in any mammal, then they're hoping that they can ultimately be able to promote regeneration in other mammals, including humans.
From removing skin to live another day, our next story looks at how removing something else can actually help increase your lifespan.
Yes, that something else being testosterone, which is something that a lot of researchers have looked into. Of course, it's well known that women on average live longer than men. Mm-hmm. And testosterone is one of the potential reasons why people have spent a lot of energy researching this and the effects of testosterone on longevity. And one way that researchers can actually try to understand this problem is to look at men who have been castrated and compare them with uncastrated men. The problem with that is that you often don't have a really large sample size. Mm-hmm. So studies have been done, but they had really mixed results in the past.
So how did the researchers go about finding these eunuchs?
Well, in this one case, it turns out that there is a centuries-long record of eunuchs, and this comes from a genealogical record from Korea. Korean rulers used to keep eunuchs to serve in the royal court, and there was actually a record of their births and their deaths that was kept from basically the 16th through the mid-19th century. And so there's actually this amazing document. It was about 385 men whose lives were detailed in this. Mm-hmm. So that's a sample set that, you know, no other researcher had access to make this kind of comparison.
And so how much longer were these eunuchs actually living?
They were only able to verify the lifespans of 81 of the men. But of those 81, it turns out that on average they lived 14 to 19 years longer than men of similar social status at the time. And it also turns out there were three of them who lived to be 100 years old out of 81, which when you think about the usual centenarian average, it's about one in 3,100 perhaps in Japan. It's a much better average if you're a eunuch.
Why might testosterone shorten a person's life? What's sort of the mechanism working there?
Well, this is something that they don't actually know. I mean, they don't really know why testosterone might have this effect. At this point, they're just trying to establish that link. By establishing that, people are hoping that they're going to be able to move forward and actually figure out if there's some therapy that would not actually involve removing anything, but could help lengthen lives.
Yeah, let's hope they can find a less invasive way to go about increasing longevity. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, on Science Now this week, you can learn about how monitoring more fisheries might pay off, and also what happens to all the gas and dust that is swirling around a black hole. And also on our policy blog, Science Insider, you can learn about a report that shows that funding cuts to public universities are actually very significant state to state, and also recommendations to NASA for Mars exploration into the next decade and beyond. And finally, next week on Science Live, you can chat with experts about how societies such as a New Guinea tribe that is known for warfare can actually move from war to peace. And you can check all of this out and more on our website, news.sciencemag.org.
Carolyn Gramling, thanks for talking with me.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Carolyn Gramling is a staff writer for Science. You can check out all our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the September 28th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.